I'm going to give a presentation on the moral plots, and I would also like to acknowledge Emerson Nofziger, who is also going to be giving a presentation on the moral plots tomorrow on in the residue management section, and Emerson did help me collaborate with this presentation. Not unlike most universities, the first experiment fields on most universities was around campus, and of course we were no different. And in this photo in the lower right, taken sometime in the late 1890s, after 1895, this was a construction of Davenport Hall, which was the first College of Agriculture building located there on our quad. And if you look to the southeast of the buildings, you can see where the experimental fields were located, called the Davenport plots. And the moral plots are situated just south of the observatory, which is located here, built in 1895. So these plots were kind of the precursor for some of the other experimental fields that we had developed in the outer part of the state. One thing unique about Davenport Hall is this quotation made by our university president in 1903. It said that the strength of Illinois, or the wealth of Illinois, is in her soil, and her strength lies in its intelligent development. Now, that's pretty good to have a university president have that kind of an appreciation for agriculture. Our experiment station in the early 1900s developed a system of soil experiment fields, which were located throughout the state of Illinois, to evaluate the productivity of the different soil types that we had. A lot of the basic and applied research that was done on soil fertility was done at these locations. And Cyril Hopkins was one of the primary forces in having these fields established, and did a lot of his work at these experimental fields. And this is one of his famous publications called Bread from Stones, where he took a look at the effect of wheat and the additions of manure, lime, and phosphate to the soil to increase yield. The moral plots themselves were established in 1876. Manly Miles is credited with starting the experiment with the cooperation of George E. Morrow, and the objective was to study the effects of crop rotations on yield. There was a belief that the soils in Illinois were so fertile that you could manage these soils intensively without putting any inputs back into the soil. And so that was the concept. It was a soil exhaustion experiment. The soil at the Morrow plots is a Flanagan silt loam. Now, this is a very productive soil, high in organic matter, has a silt loam surface, a silty clay loam texture, subsoil. It has a high water holding capacity, and it's an excellent soil. Originally, there were 10 plots in the Morrow plot system, and the first plots, 1 and 2, were terminated in 1895 when they constructed the observatory. Plots 6 through 10, after 1904, were abandoned, and there's no record or written record in the Morrow plot's notes as to exactly why that was. And only plots 3, 4, and 5 continue today. And they originally had no fertilizer before the inception of the experiment in 1904. To take a look at the history and the soil treatments and some of the results, to give you an idea exactly how the plots have changed over time and the number of iterations that we have on these original three plots that we now call the Morrow plots in 2009. Experiment 23 rotation study. Now, from 1876 until 1904, there was no fertilizer applied. The only treatment was crop rotation. Plot 3 was continuous corn, and it had been in continuous corn. Plot 4 was a two-year rotation of corn and oats. And plot 5 was a corn, oats, and clover rotation, a three-year rotation. All of the residues were removed from the plots, so there was no input back into the plots, just basically studying the evaluation of rotation. If we take a look at the trends of the yield, you can see that as cropping rotation sequence increased from 1, 2, and 3, that we did see a trend of increasing yield. What were the lessons that we learned those first 30 years? Well, we learned that the highly fertile prairie soils could be depleted with cropping. Crop rotations can decrease the rate of depletion. Then in 1904, the three main plots were subdivided where the north half of each one of the main plots remained as an untreated check, and the south half of each plot had a manure, lime, and phosphorus treatment. There are actually two sources of phosphorus that were used. The MLRP is rock phosphate. The MLRBP is bone phosphate. If we look at the trends of yield in this particular time period, I think we can say not only as we move from continuous corn, corn oats, and corn oats clover, we see a trend of increasing yield, but also we see the response of the manure, lime, and phosphate treatment over the check. This is kind of an interesting photo, and a lot of the bulletins and publications had this kind of a presentation, so to speak. This was corn that was cut from the Morrill plots in 1909. If you move from right to left, we have the untreated check, the corn oats rotation, and the corn oats clover rotation, and below that are the weights of the individual corn ears that were harvested from that presentation. If we look at the trends of yield over 1904 and 1953, actually, and the reason why we have different years, you have to realize that we only have corn on the Morrill plots every 6 years. That's when the rotations allow us to have a uniform crop, and that's when we make a determination or evaluation of what the effect has been over the cropping rotation sequence. The main thing I want to point out is that the untreated check for both corn oats and continuous corn remained relatively flat. The introduction of hybrid corn in 1937, we saw a real response from the manure, lime, phosphate treatment and the three-year rotation. In fact, most of those plots increased by about 50% over that time period. Now, this is an important slide because it points out that the original organic matter content of the Morrill plots was certainly different, a different level starting point in 1904. And throughout the history of analyzing carbon and nitrogen on the Morrill plots, the west half, and that would be series A and B now, had lower organic matter than did the east half. All except for the south west corner of plot three. There must have been some sort of a differences in management before this experiment was initiated, because this is a pretty drastic difference in most cases. And the plots themselves are not very big. Each one of the main plots is only a third of an acre. So we have a small spatial difference, small spatial distance, but we have a large spatial difference. The trends in organic matter from this time period, again, no residues were returned to the plots themselves. We see that the untreated checks are decreasing organic matter at a much higher rate than are the manure plots. In fact, it looks like they're holding their own or the same. From this time period, I think we can say that we can say that manure, lime, and phosphorus increased crop yields but did not completely replace rotations. And the rotations increase yield, but not completely replace added nutrients. And again, on the organic matter, we dropped by about 0.65 percentage points in the untreated checks, and only by 0.14 in the manure, lime, and phosphorus plots. And the differences among rotations were small. In 1955, another treatment was added into the Morrill plots, and that was the addition of inorganic fertilizer in the B series, and that would be this row of subplots through here. So in the three rotations in the B series, we had lime, nitrogen, phosphate, and potassium at the rates of 200 pounds of N, 40 pounds of P2O5, and 30 pounds of K2O. Residues were replaced in the nitrogen treatment, but not in the other subplots. So we have additions of residue in that particular treatment. We look at the trends over time. Again, we see the same kind of trends looking at rotation, where continuous corn is lower and the three-year rotation is highest. There does seem to be an effect here, which it says in the averages that there was some differences between the two phosphorus sources. But I think I will show you later there are some other factors that may have entered into that kind of a response. But quite obvious is the fact that the addition of the nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus treatment did significantly increase yield, or did substantially increase yield. Part of the management, we're talking about challenges of management, is that the plots are small and a lot of the work is very labor intensive. So for many years the plots were hand harvested, but they were also hand planted in checked rows. And all the other operations were done from a manual basis. Okay, from the time period of 1955 to 67, again, where we had the addition of the liming treatment, this is the continuous corn data, because we only have a certain number of points in that whole period, but organic matter seems to really have remained unchanged. In fact, if we summarize the soil organic carbon from that period, we see that we did have different starting levels. That was obvious from the earlier slides. They started lower in the continuous corn and lower in the untreated checks. And the changes in organic carbon during that period were small and not consistent by rotation, soil treatment, or starting organic carbon level. And that meant, of course, at the end of that time period, that ending levels of the organic carbon still remained different. 1967 period was a time of really some major changes to the management of the Morrill plots. The corn oats rotation on plot 4 was changed to a corn soybean rotation. The manure lime and phosphate treatment was deleted from the South A series, and that would be in each one of the main plots. The South and the A series is along the west side of the plot. So we have nitrogen here, here, and here. That was assigned what we would call a shoot the moon treatment application, as was noted in the Morrill plots. And that was that we're putting on 300 pounds of nitrogen, 200 pounds of P2O5, and 200 pounds of K2O. Now, the high nitrogen treatment in this period was in effect until 1998, when it was changed back to the similar treatment of 200 pounds of nitrogen as the LNPK. Fertile applications were made according to soil tests. You know, we had that number, but when we reached a certain soil test, we wanted to maintain sufficiency levels. For the LNPK was pH 6 to 6.5, a P1 of 40, and a K test of 240 would be the minimum soil test requirements. For the high treatment, the difference would be we had a P1 test of 100 as our target, and 500 for the K test. All residues were returned to all the subplots. So none of the residues at this point was being removed. Again, looking at yield trends, we see the same type of relationship from continuous corn to corn oats and corn oats clover. We also see the yield increase associated with the added effects of nitrogen and with the manure lime and phosphate. Again, this data shows there may have been a trend that the higher nitrogen treatment didn't yield as well as the lower nitrogen treatment. And again, I think there are other associated factors that will help determine whether that was a true effect. Looking at the organic carbon over that time period, and this is for the continuous corn, and the main reason I have this slide is that we took organic carbon data about every other year during this time period. And you see that there's a lot up and down in the data, which, you know, indicates the fact that that soil test from year to year, there's a lot of variability from either sampling error, laboratory error, whatever. So to pick an individual point to start with and end with, you can pretty much start and end where you want on some of these treatments. The more plots organic carbon since that date, I think we can say that, again, we know that the soil organic carbon levels are different between subplots. There's been no substantial consistent change in soil organic carbon levels at any time in the rotations over the last 40 years. And again, we still have those differences in subplots as we had at the beginning of our 1955 time period. This slide actually just shows the relationship of the soil organic carbon and the average corn yield on Morrill plots. Now, it's not a perfect fit, but it does show that the higher subplot yields are associated with higher organic carbon. And is that a function of inherent differences in the soil organic matter, or is that an effect or a relationship to the rotation experiment? Corn yields for this particular time, mainly look at the right half of the graph from the 1960-some period to present. You know, we're seeing a real increase in yield. A lot of that's due to technology, of course, with different hybrids and different management techniques. And again, the fertilized treatments are able to respond to that type of technology, where the untreated checks have responded somewhat, but certainly not at the same level. Soybean yields from these plots during that time period, you know, they really don't care whether they are in the manure or the NPK. I mean, the added nutrients from those soybean yields are really not that much different, but of course the untreated check does show a lower yield. Challenges of managing the Morrill plots. Well, this was a challenge. You know, the Morrill plots located directly in campus, as campus expands, there's going to be some conflicts. And one of them was the construction of the undergraduate library in 1967. You can barely see the excavation off to the left, but the undergraduate library was actually built underground rather than three stories underground rather than three stories above ground in order to prevent any further shading of the Morrill plots. Morrill plots became a National Historic Landmark in 1968. This is the dedication ceremony, so the plots gained that historical status. And with that comes the opportunities. Instrument of social protest. In 1969, the Walrus student newspaper, which was an underground newspaper for the anti-war movement, had this notification, the fact that the university, because they were cooperating with the Department of Defense in developing defoliants used in the Vietnam War, that they were going to march on the Morrill plots and defoliate them. When they arrived, they were greeted by our faculty. And it was a rather interesting day. I was a student at the time. I wasn't on either side, but in reality, the group had no intention of defoliating the Morrill plots, but only to get the publicity that they needed to put their message out. So they did come, they said their piece. Our faculty did talk with them, explain to them about the Morrill plots. And from that, you know, there was recognized that we need to have more outreach to the students to help them understand exactly what we're doing. So field days and celebrations of certain significant events were held on campus at the Morrill plots in order to have our students have an appreciation of the experiment. We've had a little problem now and then with vandals, you know, located where we are on campus. You know, I've found a lot of different things inside the Morrill plots, but this was probably the most severe that I would say since I've actually started managing. That was the crop circle that was stamped into the Morrill plots. Fortunately, where they made the circle is pretty easy. Where the border came in, and this was kind of the cross of four different plots, is that the area that they actually damaged, and maybe they knew this, I don't know, but was not in an area that we would do our harvesting. So So luckily, it did not affect any yields. We did not lose any data. But we were able to catch the perpetrator on our camera overlooking the Morrill plots. Campus annoyance issues. And I will say that the method above was annoying to me also. A lot of the manure treatments, we would weigh them in the trailer, we would hand apply them. And so we got a lot of complaints, of course. You know, a lot of people don't like to smell manure when they're walking to class. So we now use a calibrated injection system. We put on, of course, our manure according to our phosphorus soil tests. So we've kind of eliminated that. But any other management that we do on the plots, whether it's spraying, any kind of pesticides at all, we do early in the morning on a Saturday or sometime where we're not affecting anyone. In a lot of cases, it's a matter of perception. And also getting equipment in and out of campus for the various harvesting activities we have is always a challenge. Soil removal concerns is a big one. Because the plots are small and there's a huge interest in evaluating the soil characteristics over time, is that we get a lot of requests for taking soil out of the plots. And we do have a Morrill Plots Committee, and we have made the determination that we need to limit the number of times that we sample soils, and we actually have a process now that they have to apply for the ability to do that. And if we have soils in our archive they can use instead, then we can do that. Limitations to interpreting the results of the Morrill plots. No replication. Now, I'm not a biometrist like Don, but I think this is a problem. There's only one main plot for each rotation. There were clear differences among the main plots before 1904 with no way to assign cause. Were they inherent? Was it because of rotations over the 30 years previously, the installation of tile drainage, or some other factor? Treatments are not randomly assigned within the main plot areas. So only the high nitrogen treatment was located in this geographic location. Only the LNPK in this particular area, and the manure in later years only on the east side. In addition to that, the plant populations are confounded within rotations and treatments. We have different planting populations in the continuous corn as we do the other rotations. Again, makes it very difficult. If we take a look at the relationship of plant populations to corn yield, well, this is a pretty good fit. You could say, well, I can make a determination about maybe which is the best plant population to apply on the Morrill plots. But the problem is each one of these dots represents a different system. It could be an untreated check at 8,000 plants. It could be the high nitrogen treatment or the LNPK at 28,000. So knowing the limitations of the problem we have, one of the things that we're moving into is the use of non-destructive soil characterization methods to develop intense data sets to be able to have a better measurement of the spatial variation within each subplot. One of the methods that we're using is EM38, measures soil conductivity. Soil conductivity is affected by many things, organic matter, carbonic cation exchange capacity, of course, soil texture, moisture content, but it does give you a very intense data set and a snapshot for that particular time, and you can see in this case that we do see differences between the areas down here where the corn oats hay rotation is, the corn soybeans, and the continuous corn. But what are they associated? What are those differences associated with? If we take a look at the individual point data and we subdivide into the subplots, you can see that there are patterns. But again, are they associated with that particular subplot treatment or for other factors? We see a relationship between soil conductivity and organic matter. I mean, we would assume that we would see this. And so, you know, the use of the EM38 is a useful tool to get an overview on a more intense scale about maybe what those relationships are. Another method that we're using is a digital cone penetrometer to measure compaction or soil strength. And this system has a probe that's on a modified Giddings probe. It It produces a set of data such as we have the tip stress, which is actually the point resistance that a root would emulate as it goes through the soil. It has a sensor on the side that measures the sleeve or the sleeve strength or the amount of cohesiveness, which is very much affected by particle size and particularly clay content. And also we have an estimation of volumetric moisture content, which in using penetrometer data is very important. If we take a look at the evaluation of the Morrill plots, this happens to be a depth segment from 27 to 36 inches. And the darker the color, the higher the soil strength. And you can see that we do have differences between the north half and the south half, east and west, in some cases on the Morrill plots. Again, are these associated with the rotation treatments over time or from other inherent properties? The same thing if we look at the deeper depths. We can see differences here. This would be the 3 North A plot here. You can see the penetration resistant curve here. And we look at 3 South A, we can see higher soil strength in this area here. Again, this is one of the high nitrogen treatments. And even in the corn oats rotation, we see differences here from the South A plot to the South C plot. And part of the reason is that this soil type, even though it is classified as Flanagan, the characteristic of Flanagan can have 40 to 60 inches of loess over glacial till. In some of these cases, the loess is thinner than it is in other areas of the plots, as determined by the data. So that is another confounding factor in evaluating the treatment response. We do see a significant relationship between soil strength and corn yield. Am I about done? Okay, we'll go through this. Now here's one thing. This is a 19-inch depth, 9 to 18-inch depth in the untreated check. And I think maybe these differences you could believe that maybe this is differences in soil rotation, crop rotation, because of that depth of the continuous corn. The last thing, we're hoping to have this in place this fall because of the weather. We're also looking at non-destructive ways of measuring soil carbon. We acquired this NIR probe, Veris Industries. I think they probably have one down in the exhibit area. But to take a look at being able to take more intense soil carbon data without having to take a lot of soil from the plots. Data analysis issues. Treatments are largely confounded, so that analysis of many treatments is impossible. And this allows, unfortunately, the use selective use of data from a particular subplot to support your bias. A systems approach is best to look at trends over time, and experimental design limitations must be detailed when publishing results. Valuable lessons are still being learned from the Morrill plots. They are an important historical landmark, but I think critical decisions about how best to use these plots and how they will best serve science and agriculture will determine their ultimate success. Thank you.